Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the African Studies Center and African American Studies Program at Boston University. Tonight's lecture is titled The City of India, the African Diaspora of the Indian Ocean. Speaking will be Dr. Henry Drool, Professor of Art History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We begin with an introduction by James Pritchett, Director of the African Studies Center.
Tonight, we want to formally acknowledge that the study of the African diaspora is not simply the study of the Black Atlantic, to use Paul Gilroy's term, that long before there was an Atlantic world, so to speak, be it black or otherwise, there was an Indian Ocean world, and it was the largest trading zone. It was the largest intercommunicating zone in the world, and Africans were part and parcel of that world. They were participant and producers of that world. Our speaker tonight, Dr. Henry Drool, is going to tell us a bit about one of those communities, the City of India. Dr. Drool is the Bascom Professor of Art History in the Department of Art History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he also holds an appointment in the Department of African American Studies at the University of Wisconsin. On the one hand, it would be easy to say this is a man who needs no introduction, yet it might be closer to the truth to say that this is a man who is rapidly reaching the point whereby an adequate introduction is no longer possible. How does one briefly encapsulate the scholarly contributions or the intellectual impact of someone who has over 90 publications to his credit, who has produced over a dozen films and videos, who has curated and co-curated over 30 exhibits, whose list of awards and honors alone runs over 3 pages, to do even minimal justice to his breadth and depth of his interest, of his expertise, would perhaps exhaust far too much of our time. So let me skip the usual reading of the CV and instead point out some of the broad areas to which Dr. Drool has turned his intellectual and analytical eye over the years. These would include Jelade mask and masquerading ceremonies in Western Nigeria, art and the perception of women in Yoruba culture, Igbado classification of Ogungun, Ifa divination shrines, art history and the role of the individual, pageantry and power in Yoruba costuming, flaming crowns, cooling waters, masquerades of the Ijebu Yoruba, hairstyles, Yoruba water spirit headdress, aesthetics and the ontology of Yoruba body art, the role of the senses in understanding art, Mami water worship in Africa, Mami water in the African Atlantic world, prints and textiles by African artists, Afro-American and Afro-Brazilian art, and closer to our topic today, 2004, Aliens and Homelands, Identity, Agency, and the Arts among the city of Uttara Kannada, and 2005, Stitching History, Patchwork Quilts by Africans, Sidi in India. Tonight's topic, Africans in South Asia, the Sidis of India, History, Culture, and the Arts. Without further introduction, Dr. Henry Drool. Thanks very much.
It's a great pleasure and an honor to be here this evening. What I'm going to do first, in the first part of the talk, is to give you a kind of brief historical overview and introduction to the presence of Africans in the Indian Ocean world, and more specifically in South Asia. And then in the second half of the talk, I'm going to take you to a slightly different African population in India, the Siddhis of northern Karnataka, a group who came under different circumstances from the earlier Africans who came to this part of the world, and talk to you about their sense of community, something of their culture, my experiences living with them, and then talk specifically at the end of the talk about this visual art tradition, this wonderful quilting tradition of Kawandi being done by Siddhi women in northern Karnataka. We're talking about the earliest period, and we know from certain early written documents that Africans are in South Asia from at least the second or third century of the current era. And they come there because they're part of these long-distance, long-standing trading networks that crisscross the Indian Ocean from the east coast of Africa into the Arabian Peninsula, up into what is now Pakistan, Iran, Pakistan, and India, back and forth on the monsoon winds. And they came as merchants. They came as admirals of small navies. They came as individuals, powerful individuals, often very rich individuals, who were beginning to establish these trading networks. And the earliest Africans, we believe, are coming from Ethiopia and from somewhere in the center part of Ethiopia and the central part, and also down toward the coast. And these Ethiopians, or Abyssinians, as they were known, were some of the earliest African presence in this area. By the 6th and the 7th century of this era, the Arabs begin to dominate the maritime trade in the Arabian Sea and the Indian Ocean generally. Many of the sailors on those ships are Africans, are Abyssinians, or Africans from Somalia and from other places up and down the East African coast. They become expert sailors, and they become essential to the development of this trade. And it's a trade that, as you know, also included human beings, who we label as slaves, but I think we need to understand them in a different way from the way we talk about slaves and slavery in the Atlantic world. It's a very, very different kind of system, and its roots and its foundation is based upon a different concept. One of the essential concepts is that a slave is not property and therefore non-human. A slave has a particular role, particular status to play, but the person is seen as a full human being. And being a full human being, they have the possibility of achieving what other human beings, can achieve. And I want to read a short excerpt of an explanation of the concept of slavery in the Indian Ocean by Amitav Ghosh, an author that many of you may know, where he explains the arrangement in this way. It is not a master-slave relationship, but rather more a patron-client relationship. And that's, I think, the way we need to understand this. If this seems curious, he says, it's largely because the medieval idea of slavery tends to confound contemporary conceptions, both of servitude and its mirrored counter-image, individual freedom. In the Middle Ages, institutions of servitude took many forms, and they all differed from, quote, slavery as it came to be practiced after the European colonial expansion of the 16th century. In the Middle East and in northern India, for instance, slavery was the principal means for recruitment into some of the most privileged sectors of the army and the bureaucracy. For those who made their way up through that route, slavery was thus often a kind of career opening, a way of gaining entry into the highest levels of government. And I don't think he overstates the case. I think this is very much the situation. So what I'm going to kind of relate to you and I'm going to focus on one particular area where the presence of Africans who are known either as Habshi or as Siddi. Habshi comes from the Arabic reference to the land of the blacks, or Habash, a reference to Ethiopia and to Africa generally. So Africans in India were known as Habshi. But they were also known as Siddi and widely known as Siddi. And we think that it comes perhaps from an Arabic term of respect for somebody in an important position with high rank. Because from about the 13th and 14th centuries, Africans have been brought as slaves, as clients with their patrons, because I want you to kind of rethink that use of the term, to India with the expansion of Islam and the establishment of sultanates throughout the subcontinent. and they come through the slaving markets of the Middle East, through Baghdad. One very famous one comes through Baghdad. I'll be talking about his history shortly. And they are brought up in families of powerful men, merchants, military leaders, government officials, sultans, so they're in the courts. And they rise through the ranks. And they are able to do so because they come with reputations, especially those from Ethiopia and Somalia, reputations of being courageous, brave, and loyal. These are the attributes that are associated with them. And their loyalty is undivided because they have only their patron, the person who brings them to that part of the world, that they have an allegiance to. And so they are given trusted positions where they are court officials. And quite a number of Siddis became prime ministers or regents. So they actually ruled sultanates at various times, the most famous being Malik Ambar, who I'm going to talk about. Malik, that wasn't his original name. He had an Ethiopian name. He was taken either as a war captive in a slave raid to his village in southeastern Ethiopia, or he was sold into slavery by his impoverished parents. There are both of these stories. He's taken to the slave markets at Baghdad and then purchased by a person, a Turkish elite person, a merchant, I think, who then goes to South India to become part of the developing states in the Deccan. And he brings up Malik Ambar within his family. Malik distinguishes himself and his intelligence and his quickness to learn, and he is given responsibilities very early on. He is sold again a second time, and this time he is sold to another Siddi, a powerful Siddi official who also has slaves, that is, clients. And he takes on Malik Ambar as one of his clients. And Malik begins to distinguish himself as a military genius. He begins to form a force of soldiers because of the force of his personality and his presence. Many soldiers who are leaving other armies come to join his. And he develops at his height an army of, I think, something like 6,000 or 7,000 soldiers. Because of political circumstances, I can't go into the details now, but the ruler in Ahmednagar is dethroned, and there is an interregnum. And Malik Ambar, with his powerful position, military position, manages to negotiate and orchestrate a regency, and he also has his daughter marry the next intended ruler, so that he makes family connections, and during that regency, he becomes the prime minister of that sultanate. He essentially runs the show. And so he reigns from 1600 until 1626, when he dies. So for 26 years, for a quarter of a century, he rules the sultanate of Ahmednagar, which is being attacked by Mughal forces from the north and Marathi forces from the east and the British and the Dutch from the coast. And yet he manages to play off these various forces, these various enemies of each other, against each other, and manages to enlarge his sultanate and his power. Now, Malik Ambar, and he's known in the Indian literature as the inventor of guerrilla warfare, because his military strategies were so successful, even though his force was smaller than those who he was fighting against, he was able to be successful. But more than his military genius, Malik Ambar was a civil and a civic leader of the highest quality. And during his reign in Aurangabad and also at in other cities in the area, he built civic structures. He built this entrance gate into Aurangabad, and this is the Mehmood Gate of Aurangabad on the right. He created fortifications around the entire city. He built a water supply system of cisterns and canals that is still being used in Aurangabad today. He built the Kali Masjid or mosque that you see here on the right, the interior of it, and he built two or three mosques during his reign, as well as a palace, as well as public marketplaces. He also instituted a reformed system of taxes and revenues and put into cultivation land that had not been used before. And it is that system of taxation and distribution of revenue for civic purposes that was being used in Aurangabad in this part of the Deccan until the early part of the 20th century. Malik Ambar is probably the most famous of a large number of Siddhi prime ministers, regents, admirals, generals, who served in various states all throughout the Deccan for this 300 or 400 year period. This is Malik Ambar's tomb, which is near Ellora. It's in a kind of cemetery area called Kuldabad, which means heavenly abode. And Malik Ambar's tomb is among those of all of the other sultans who reigned in that era and in that area. So he was among the most important individuals in this part of the world at that particular time. All right, now I want to turn to, just briefly, another example of Siddhi African presence in the Deccan, this time on the coast, and I'm coming to this marine fort called Janjira. I said earlier on that Africans come into the Indian Ocean world as expert sailors, merchantmen. And some of them they manned ships that guarded the merchant ships that traversed the Indian Ocean. They were kind of like, they were not the Coast Guard, they were the Navy. They were the military that were protecting the goods coming back and forth. Now, they were the ones who were responsible for ensuring safe passage for Muslim pilgrims going to Mecca, traveling across the Indian Ocean. The Siddhis were also instrumental in the trade in horses, in Arabian horses, to the Indian subcontinent. They were crucial to that whole mercantile back and forth. Now, for their enemies, the Siddhis were the supreme pirates of these Indian Ocean waters. They were hated by the Dutch, by the French, and by the English, because the Siddhis would often poach and capture the cargoes and capture the ships of those other traders in the Indian Ocean. Well, the home base of those Siddhi sailors, ruled by the Nawab of Muru Janjira, which is the area that this fort is in. This is 90 miles south of Bombay. Janjira is a fort that became the place of the control of this Siddhi navy from about the 15th century onward until about the mid-19th century. And the fort itself was occupied until about 1960, 1970. There was a small community. But at its height, this marine fort, which is described by all of those who are experts in South Asian fortifications, the finest marine fort ever constructed, is a fort that is off the coast. There is about a three-quarter to 1 mile distance between this fort and land. It gets a little bit narrower in low tide and a little bit wider in high tide. And the Marathi military leaders who wanted to try to capture this fort from the Siddhis lamented, how can one capture a fort whose moat is the sea? And for 300 years, the Siddhis kept this fort, held this fort against all the enemies that tried to capture it from them. The fort had originally belonged to a Koli king in this area, the Koli people in this part of the Konkan coast, and it was originally a wooden fortification. But over the first centuries, I think part of it had already been converted into the stone fortification by the 14th century, and then the Siddhis who occupied it began to develop it even further. And there are lots of stories about how they captured it from that Koli king. I won't go into those details now. But there is an audience hall that was five stories high and a smaller private audience hall that was three stories in height. There was an elaborate palace and right in front of it was a large tank or water supply. There were actually two major water supplies within this fort. So no siege of the fort could succeed because they had sufficient drinkable water within the fort. It's an extraordinary structure, and so far nothing much has been done with it, which has preserved many of the elements, but I think the Museum Survey of India is hoping to reconstruct some of the elements of it. So this is Janjira Fort, an amazing site and evidence of the Siddhi presence. The Siddhis of Janjira were ruled by an elite Siddhi, the Siddhi Nawab of Janjira, Muru Janjira. During the colonial period in India, the British allowed princely states to survive or to remain in a kind of semi-independent existence. And so there were a number of independent Siddhi princely states ruled by Nawabs, and Janjira was one of them. So this Nawab, and they were very rich, powerful individuals, he built his palace. It said that elements of this mansion or palace are based on Windsor Castle from England. And inside I found some iron staircase going up to the balcony that had been cast in Cincinnati, Ohio. And he had stained glass windows brought in from France. So it's quite an elegant place, but now very run down and abandoned. So this is the kind of history of these early arrivals from Africa, the Siddhis who are coming from Ethiopia and then from up and down the East African coast from about 1100 up until 18th century. And these are many of their roles. Now, there's also another history that starts at the end of the 15th century with the arrival of the Portuguese in the Indian Ocean. And so the next community of Africans, this the second part of the talk, is about those who came as a result of European slave raiding on the east coast of Africa. And the earliest were the Portuguese. And the Portuguese began to contest Arab dominance of the Indian Ocean, and they set up their headquarters in what became Goa. And Goa, or Old Goa, was the richest center in the Portuguese Empire at a particular point in the early part of the 16th, the first half of the 16th century. And the Portuguese were bringing Africans from the east coast of Africa, probably from the region in and around Mozambique, where they also established a presence. But they were probably drawing Africans from other places through Zanzibar, up and down the East African coast, and into the interior as the trade in human beings expanded. So from about 1500 onward, the Portuguese bring Africans to Goa from those sources. They don't come in very large numbers because it's not essentially a plantation economy. So it's not on the same kind of scale as what happens in the Atlantic world. But nonetheless, it's a fairly substantial one, and it goes on for quite a long time. The Africans who come are there in Goa, and many of them are in domestic service in the households of these rich Portuguese elite and church members as well. At a certain point, they begin to disappear from that situation of bondage. We don't know the stories, the stories about that. We don't have the details. I've been trying to collect oral histories from various people who are the descendants of those, but there aren't many details. But what essentially happens is that the Siddhis begin to leave the coastal area of Goa, where the Portuguese control, and find refuge in Indian communities, usually Hindu communities, who have no love for the Portuguese because the Portuguese are destroying their temples and trying to convert people to Catholicism, to Christianity. So they begin to move into the interior, and as they move into the interior, they come into an area along the coast running north and south is a mountain range called the Western Ghat Mountains, G-H-A-T-T, Ghat Mountains. And those mountains on the western coast, because of the monsoons, are very densely forested, very thickly forested, and pretty much impenetrable. And then on the eastern side of that mountain range, it's a high plateau and fairly dry, okay? So they go into the Western Ghat Mountains, and essentially what they do is they set up quilombos. Now, quilombo is a word that comes from my work in Brazil. You have to know what a quilombo is. It's a Bantu word that refers to independent communities of Africans who escaped slavery in Brazil. And there are some very famous ones from the 17th and 18th century, the most famous being Palmares. This is what Africans in this part of the world do as well. They go into the forest and they set up their communities in these impenetrable forests, and they begin to work the land or to survive, and they create their own sense of community. And they live separate from Hindu communities or other Indian communities, but they interact with them. But they have gone out of the range of influence and impact of the Portuguese, who are essentially on the coast and in what is Goa, and not very far into the interior. And it's those communities, the descendants of those original Cimarron or Maroon communities, these independent African communities that I have worked with in northern Karnataka. They have become settled agriculturalists. They also raise domestic animals. And they carved out the land in this forest. Now they've got a whole other challenge before them, because they escaped Portuguese slavery and they established their own land where they could in these forests. But now the Indian government has turned those forests into national parks. And one of the first things that happens to the people who inhabit national parks is that they have to leave. Now, there are negotiations going on, but many Siddhi communities have been forced off of the land that they cleared and that they have worked for several generations, since at least the 17th and 18th centuries. And what's happened to them is they no longer own their land, but they've become agricultural workers on rich landowners' land. Do you see the image of a plantation reemerging? And then the thing that really blew my mind, I found out what crop they're grazing on their landlord's land, and it's cotton. That's what they're raising. So now they have small farms, but maybe 4 or 5 acres at the most. So it's subsistence agriculture, and they make a living by working on other people's land, since they have been forced off of the land that they worked in these forest areas. So it's a real struggle. It's a whole other dynamic and dimension that they're working against and with. Now, the Siddhis in this area live in small villages. The community that I know best, I was introduced to through the work of Jesuits who work in liberation theology ways in India. That is, they are workers for social justice at the same time that they are proponents of Christianity. And there are a number of service organizations, the Jesuits who work mainly with education, and there's another Catholic organization, the Sisters of the Holy Cross, and these are Indian sisters from different parts of India, but the original order was started in Switzerland, and they work mainly on health issues, but also economic issues, and they live in and work in a number of these communities, the one that I stayed in. They are a big presence. So most of the Siddhis in that community of Mainalay are Catholic or Christian of other denominations, but most of them are Catholic. Many of them still speak, at least the older generation, speak the remnants of the language that their grandparents and great-grandparents knew from Goa, that is Konkani. But they speak a particular dialect of Konkani called Siddhi Konkani. And it's distinctive enough so that an ethno-linguistic, historical linguist who's working there in northern Karnataka is trying to pull out elements of the African elements of this Siddhi Konkani dialect to see if we can figure out where they might have come from in Africa. And I don't know if he's going to succeed or not, but we'll see. So that's one of the attempts. So they speak Konkani. And that linguistic heritage is coming from their movement out of Goa and into Karnataka. Now the younger generation is going to school, and so they speak the official language of Karnataka, which is Kannada. They're also learning English, and they speak Konkani at home. The Siddhis are probably in, now I'm moving to the arts, the last section of the talk. The Siddhis are probably most known for their performance arts. They have a reputation as outstanding singers and dancers and musicians. Many Siddhis from that earlier historical period and up until the very present were court musicians. We have some marvelous Deccani paintings and Gujarati paintings depicting Siddhi court musicians. Well, that reputation continues right up until the present, so that every Independence Day in India, there are at least one or two or three Siddhi groups that are performing in Delhi as part of the government celebrations of independence. And whenever I would ask, well, you know, what's most African about, you know, what you have among you and with you today? And they would say, it's the drum. That drum came from Africa. It's the drum that connects us to our homeland that we never knew. So the dhamam is the key musical instrument. So it's the older generation that knows how to play dhamam and dance the dhamam drum very well. When I went to some weddings in Karnataka, the dhamam drum lasted for about an hour, you know, from about 11 till about midnight. And then at midnight, the sound system was turned on and all of the younger generation was dancing the latest disco tunes. So I'm not sure how much longer dhamam music is going to be around, but there are younger musicians who are also learning it. And there's a kind of revival and reconnection to certain performance traditions. And the dancing style for dhamam is very African. It's very down, very polyrhythmic, very loose, lots of polyrhythms going on in the performance, very, very different from the Indian dance styles in the area that we know of. I found out, I'm an art historian. So when I went to Siddhi country, I was looking for the arts. But I like to call myself an arts historian. I'm not just interested in the visual arts, I'm interested in performance, in music and dance and song. So I was looking for all of it, and it was the performing arts that I first learned about and began to write about. It wasn't until the second or third trip that I took back to this community, because I had been looking for visual art traditions, that I found out about this one. And I found out about it by waking up one morning and looking at what I was sleeping on in the house with the family that I was staying with, because the interior of those houses is dark. And I hadn't noticed what she had laid out on the sleeping mat for me. And it was one of these quilts. So there is a very vibrant tradition of patchwork quilts among Siddhi women. The style of their quilts, it's not to say that they are the only women who make patchwork quilts in this part of India, but the style of their quilts is quite distinctive from their neighbors with whom they have lived. They live with the Lambani and the Gauri, who are, one group is semi-nomadic. These are so-called tribals in India. They're not Hindus, they are indigenous peoples of the area, and the Siddhis have often interacted with them. So there may be influence going back and forth, artistic influence going back and forth between these various groups, but that's something that I haven't been able to really research. I need another 90 articles to work on that. So what the women will do is they will take pieces of clothing that can no longer be worn. They've gone to shreds. So they'll save the bits of cloth that are still salvageable, gather them together, and when they have enough, they'll begin to create a patchwork quilt. What they'll do is they'll go to the market and purchase a cotton sari, or two cotton saris, and then the sari becomes the backing for this different array of patches of clothing. And those patches of clothing are, in essence, a visual history of the fashions of the family member for the last maybe 4, 5, 6 years. That's what these patchwork quilts are about. And then they may also go to the market, to secondhand clothing markets, which are a big global phenomenon in India and certainly in Africa and many other parts of the world, and they'll buy bundles of secondhand clothing to make these quilts. And it's the women who make them for their daughters and their granddaughters within the family. And they're used as either covers in the monsoon, the cool monsoon season, or they're used as bedding or mattresses, sleeping quilts, to lie upon in the warm season. And that's how I discovered it. With a colleague of mine who some of you may know, Pashington Obeng, who teaches at Wellesley and at Harvard, we've been working in the same communities. He's interested in their religious life, their beliefs and practices, but we were both interested in, as trying to give back something to the communities that we were working in. So I started to ask the women and these Sisters of the Holy Cross, the Indian sisters who have lived and worked with them for about 10 years now, if there were any way we could turn this activity into a money-making activity. And so the Sydney women got together, and they decided to form themselves into a cooperative. And that cooperative is called the Sydney Women's Quilting Cooperative. Strangely enough, that's the name that we came up with. Quilts are either made communally, the equivalent of a quilting bee, in a sense, where women who are friends will work together. But also women were making their own individual quilts for their family members. And women who gained a reputation of fine quilters were often asked by friends and neighbors to make quilts for an impending wedding or for the impending birth of a child. And then they would be given, a chicken or a goat or some food in payment for their work on these quilts. So it's a patchwork quilt. It's a long running stitch that goes from the outside edge into the center. I understand that working from the outside edge to the middle is much tougher than working from the middle to the outside edge, which is normally the way a quilt is done, from the center outward. Sydney women do it from the outer edge to the middle. The Sydneys have their own aesthetic, clearly defined aesthetic for these quilts. There's a whole tradition of making baby quilts. It's in these baby quilts that women will put a kind of special attention to another feature that is highly prized in a fine quilt, and that is tikli. Tikli are little squares or rectangles of cloth that are sewn in and applied on the surface, sometimes on the top of larger areas, rectangular areas of fabric. These tikli are like little stars in a constellation. And Sydney women explained to me that they want to produce something that's bright and complex in design to energize the children, to wake up the kids, to keep them lively. There is a piece of cloth of a different color, or sometimes white, that's folded double times, and then it's stitched into the corner in the four corners. I said, well, why is that there? Because it served no function as far as I could see. And they said, it must be there. In order for a quilt to be complete, it has to have pula in the corner. And pula means flower. Has to have a flower in the back at each of the corners. And she went on to explain to me, she said, if we did a quilt and we didn't put the flowers in the corners, the quilt would be naked. That is unfinished, incomplete, and not proper. So this is another thing that you will find in every one of them. So that's your introduction to Sydneys of India.
Thank you very much for a very fascinating presentation. And my head was just because I come from the Caribbean and with Indians there and doing the Atlantic diaspora, it really resonates with me. One of the things I was thinking about is that at some point in reading some of the Portuguese documents for the East Africa, especially Zimbabwe, that Gao-Zimbabwe connection, the Portuguese also carried, in fact, members of the elite, the ruling classes of Zimbabwe. Some young men went and, in fact, were confirmed or christened, and then went to school in Goa and actually came back. So I wondered if you had done any work in the archives itself to see if there is, you know, if you can trace people who may have elite from that other East African coast who may have remained.
That's an excellent question, and so I think there are probably many stories similar to that. But I'm going to leave it to you historians. You know, I went to India the first time in 2001, and like a good arts historian, I said, well, I better start with the archives, shouldn't I? So I went to the Portuguese archives that are in Goa, and I think I lasted 2 weeks. And then I decided I hadn't come to India to look at Portuguese documents in an archive. I'm sorry, but that's not what I came to do. I understand the importance of it, and there's a great importance of it, and I must say that my history, my collection of oral history among the communities that I lived in is very shallow. I was not very successful. I have to go back and do a lot more on that. But that's what I was interested in. I was interested in the living presence of Africa and Africans in India. And I had a connection to these communities in Karnataka, and I took it. And I said goodbye to Goa and to the dusty archives, and I said hello to the Mainalay community and other communities in northern Karnataka. But I'm sure that that's happened. That rings true, because the Portuguese did that in other places. They did it in Congo, as you know. You know, so there must have been lots of other instances of that as they were Christianizing and taking people of a particular rank and position to help them in their colonizing efforts in other parts of the world. So I have not found an example of that. And I have talked to other colleagues who did spend appropriate amounts of time in the Goan archives. And they've come to references of Africans mainly in domestic service, not in positions of missionizing or of in leadership or of in more advanced education in Goa, who were then to go back to Africa. That I am not aware of. And I think it's an interesting part of this story. We oversimplify, we condense these histories, and the complexity of the experiences that Africans had over this 1,000-year history in this part of the world is just extraordinary. It was mind-blowing. And I'm just a beginner at this. I can only pick a topic like a baby quilt to try to understand, because, you know, if I were a Hindu, I could say, well, I'll do it in my next lifetime. But I'm not sure I'm coming back. So, you know, I spent most of my time in West Africa and in Brazil and in the Atlantic world, and India is of interest to me, but I'm not the one who's going to really do the work. It's going to have to be others.
Okay, thank you very much. Congratulations on a fascinating talk. And I'm curious about a couple of things. One of them is, since we're talking about diaspora, what kind of relationship did you get a sense of that the city people have with an ancestral homeland in Africa? And the other question is, how are they inserted in the caste system of India?
Okay, two very good questions, very difficult questions that are not easily answered. First, there, the Siddhis that I knew and talked with and got to know personally, and who I would ask about this question, what's your relationship to Africa? For the most part, that question has come to them from non-Siddhis, like myself or Indians from other part of India, or Jesuits who understand that history. The Siddhis, most of the Siddhis, especially of the older generation who did not go to school, don't know about the early history of Africans. And the early history that I talked about in the first part of the talk is actually a history of it's a different world, and they come for a different situation. These are Africans who come via Portuguese and other Europeans at a later point. But their history could only The oral histories that I was able to collect would take them back maybe two, at the most three generations. And in that time span, they could tell me that they came to Mainalay from Darwar. And before they came to Darwar, they had been in Bellary. And before Bellary, they don't know. And that route that I've just traced for you is from northern Karnataka back into the interior of Goa, to the forest area of Goa. And beyond that, they couldn't say. So they would tell me, well, people tell us we're African, but we don't know where we come from, and we don't know anything about Africa. What's interesting is that I went to one city household and asked the same question, and he said, yes, I know where I'm from. I'm from Nairobi, Kenya. I said, okay, let me turn on my tape recorder. I want to hear this story. Well, it turns out that 1 month before, he had met a Kenyan student studying in the university at Darwad, because there are lots of African students who come to do their university training in India, as the universities in Africa have their political and economic problems. So they come to India for a university training. Many of the Kenyans who make it to India come through Christian missionizing connections. So these African students at the university at Darwad were missionizing among their brothers and sisters from Africa, and one of them said, you come from Nairobi, Kenya. So that's where he comes from. And that's the oral history that I collected. I think I'm a failure as a historian.
I had wanted to ask you if you had made any encounter or further studies of the music that the Sidhis in Karnataka were using. I was in Hyderabad in 1998 with the team that I'm sure you're familiar with.
Oh, and yeah, the Crossroads team?
Pardon?
The Crossing Borders team.
Crossing Borders team, yes. And we encountered in Hyderabad a dance and music that was actually exactly the same dance that I was researching in Tanzania.
Yes.
with memory, where they said, yes, the most sort of African thing was certainly the drumming and the music.
Yes.
but, of course, not being an ethnomusicologist but an art historian, it's not something that I necessarily followed. But I was wondering if in your encounters with music, once again having a very strong sort of cultural memory as being African, with the Sidhis that you were working with, has there been any attempt to try to connect up with music from Eastern Africa that might give a little bit more of a background as to, is it not just the drum, but the songs themselves or the
right.
uses themselves?
Yes. Good question. There are certain songs from northern Karnataka that are identified by Sidhis as more African, and then other songs that they've taken from Konkani culture on the coast and now in Karnataka. So that varies. But the drum is universally understood as a drum that comes from Africa and that is an African instrument, musical instrument. Unfortunately, there aren't any ethnomusicologists that have worked in detail in this area as far as I know. But you, I'm sure, are familiar with Amy Catlin and her work in Gujarat. Well, Gujarat. And also I can say something about Hyderabad, because I wasn't able to put the AC Guards folks of Hyderabad into this talk. I just couldn't do it. But there you have these Dup Arabi bands that are performed by Africans who were born primarily in the 19th century. So they're late arrivals. And they come to work as the bodyguard, a cavalry and a personal bodyguard for the Nizam of Hyderabad. Because of that tradition of warriorhood that comes with them, okay, that reputation. But when the court is disbanded and they no longer have jobs, they still keep their housing, their abodes in one particular quarter of Hyderabad where the AC guards or the African cavalry guard lives and the descendants of those cavalry guards live. Well, they've taken up that second reputation. The reputation is fine performers and singers. So they perform at weddings and other kinds of celebrations, and they form themselves into these musical groups. My understanding of the Hyderabad music is that it is much closer to Yemeni and Arabian Peninsula music, Afro-Yemeni and Afro-Saudi Arabian music, Omani, since the Omanis were big players in this whole Indian Ocean trade, that music is coming out of that peninsular tradition and varies somewhat when it reaches Hyderabad. Okay? So that's one Siddhi musical tradition in that part of the continent, Damam in Karnataka. And then in Gujarat, there's also these very direct connections to Swahili coast culture and to Swahili coast song. But there's also a wonderful, wonderful other element that brings in Bantu, because they play an instrument they call the malunga. And they call it, they have a slightly different name for it, and I'm blanking on that name, but the malunga is a single-stringed instrument with a gourd resonator and a long curve, the same single-stringed harp carried by Bantu Africans to Brazil and called birimbau in Brazil is the same instrument Africans took to Gujarat, and they still use. And there's a last generation of the men, the older men who knew how to make them and play them and string them. And so they did a workshop to encourage the next generation to continue that, because the malunga was about to disappear as an instrument that's played for Bava Gor in Ratanpur at the shrine of a Siddhi saint, a Sufi saint, which is another whole story. Okay. Yeah.
You've been listening to a lecture presented by the African Studies Center and African American Studies Program at Boston University. Tonight's lecture was titled The Siddhi of India, the African Diaspora of the Indian Ocean. Speaking was Dr. Henry Drool, Professor of Art History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We began with an introduction by James Pritchett, Director of the African Studies Center. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back.